Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Boys, I'm mellow as a honeydew. Yeah.
That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Oh man, he's high. Yes, higher than a kite. Baba doody. That cat is high. Look that look in his eye. Man, I
welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte. Today, we have good friend of the show, repeat guest, and all-around whiskey aficionado and badass, Nick Jarrett.
Hello, everyone. Glad
welcome
to be
back. Welcome back. So, this has been a show that we've been talking about for weeks, if not months now.
Oh, absolutely.
The issues at hand in the modern whiskey world, specifically the way that, well, we're going to talk about a lot of things, but specifically the way that the proof has been dropping on certain whiskeys, specifically rye and Old Overhaul for one.
Absolutely.
And then also with the rye boom over the past few years, it's kind of, I mean, it's a very exciting time for whiskeys, but at the same time, it's like there are a lot of kind of shady decisions being
sort
made.
Sort of sleeper problems going on that no one's paying attention to. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
One of those being, like, you know, obviously we were talking about right before the show about Old Overhaul bottled in bond.
Absolutely.
And I can't wait to try it because I've actually never had it. This is the 8-year red cap bottled in bond. But before we get into that,
sure.
Let's talk a little bit about, Old Overhaul as a company and the history of the actual spirit.
Well, yeah, sure. Old Overholt's one of the classic and really a long, actually, it's the only really remaining example of a legacy label of Western Pennsylvanian rye. Rittenhouse is still kicking around, but they were always Eastern Pennsylvania in the Philadelphia area. So Old Overholt has roots as a label and a company that go back to 1810 and Monongahela rye in general, which were one of the country's first popular spirits right after rum really took off and then went down after the Revolution. So, it's always been a favorite of mine. It's a great bottle. It was picked up and run through Prohibition by the American Medicinal Spirits Company as a medicinal whiskey, which was sort of a dodge on still getting your, brown liquors during the whole ill-conceived decision to ban alcohol in this country. And American Medical Spirits sort of bought up a bunch of old stock and then labels, converted to national distillers after Prohibition was repealed. Ran as a company with a number of other products, I believe Old Grandad, Mount Vernon, I think, was part of their category, and at least one other, up until they're purchased by Beam in the 70s. Beam sort of switched over the Overhaul to mash bill and formula and began making some changes to the product line. The only one that they really kept distinct was Old Grandad, because Old Grandad as a high rye bourbon was so different from their current mash bill that the drinkers in market focus groups rejected Jim Beam as Old Grandad. But it's a fantastic product. And actually, let's drink a little bit of today's Old Overhaul right now.
This one to me is always, it's always had that like kind of peanut, like nutty kind of thing, you know, like super light and.
Yeah, we were talking about like peanut shells before, and you still get like a little bit of fruit in the background. Like, there's some strange like tropical notes going on. I always get a little bit of a hint of mango and like some tropical stuff way in the background. And rye traditionally was a very fruity beverage in its youth. I don't have any here today, but I was drinking some Maryland rye recently, and I was floored by just exactly how banana and like crazy mango and fruity that style of rye was. But Old Overhaul is one of a couple of ryes that we've had around continuously since Prohibition. It's remained in production, although traded off, but kind of been on, you know, more or less a downhill slant over the past 20, 30, 40 years.
And why is that? Did it just fall out of vogue? I mean, like, did it have anything to do with, you know, other spirits becoming more popular? Was it availability, or was it a little bit of everything?
Well, I think that we have to sort of discuss the fact that, first, with Prohibition, American taste changed substantially. Liquor was pretty difficult to get a hold of, especially American liquor, for 13 years. Taste sort of switched over to Canadian whiskey,
blended
which
rye.
Which was much more available. And America's always had a strong tradition of blended rye. Maryland, again, in particular, was a huge, like, that was sort of the house style, though it was blended straights. Canadian rye uses some very, very high rye content, and it blends with a lot of just neutral grain and then corn. So after Prohibition, people were drinking more imports. Blended scotch was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly on the heels of Prohibition, of course, vodka blew up.
Right.
In the 60s, there was a whole introduction of new classifications of whiskey, you know, light whiskey, blended whiskey, spirit whiskey, which were whiskey companies trying to hop on and fight, like, the fact that vodka and lighter spirits like rum were rapidly cannibalizing their sales. So everyone was trying to take the flavor out of whiskey and, you know, denatured quite a few good products. Now, we do have here today a little bit of a bottle of some 1951 Old Overholt bottled in bond, aged 8 years, which is very different from what we just drank. It's made, actually, this bottle was made in Broadford, Pennsylvania, before the Pennsylvania distillery was closed. It's 100 proof, not 80 proof, as a bottled in bond is required by law.
Mm-hmm.
It's 8 years old as opposed to 4 years old, and I mean, even today, the bonding regulations have changed, but this one is actually vintage dated. So it's one distiller, one season. This particular season was 1951, and it was bottled in 1960. So let me just pour a little quick sip of that.
Absolutely.
Us.
I've been waiting for this moment for a while.
Oh, hell yeah.
And another thing about the... this is 1951 to 1960. When did they go from 100 proof... they dropped to 86 proof, and then they dropped to 80. When do you think that was?
You know, I'm not 100% sure on when they dropped the bonding. I'm pretty sure that happened even before National was picked up by Jim Beam.
Okay.
Which was just part of a general trend in reducing proof in spirits in general to introduce lighter flavors. Now, you'll notice right off the bat that you can't say that this is light at all. This bottle was full when I opened it, unopened. I've obviously taken a couple of nips out of it since then. But
Jesus Christ.
This is some good 60-year-old bourbon that we're about to drink here. And it definitely does evolve in the bottle because congeners sort of adjust over time.
That is really, really good.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's...
And you get the Rickhouse in this. You know, on
sure.
the nose and in the palate.
There's wood, but then, like, the fruit starts opening up. And there's the fruit in the rye that I used to be talking about. Rye, as you age it for a long time, like bourbon, like, you get a lot more sort of herbal, herbaceous, like, notes that come out of it. But a medium-aged rye, like, once you have enough age on that it begins to mellow out, which is really a little bit more than 4 years.
Right.
Which is unfortunate, one of the difficulties with rye today. The wood starts to sort of cover up the harshness, and you just get, like, this is a fruit bomb to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy. This is tropical.
Absolutely.
From Broadford, Pennsylvania, you know. You still have a little bit of that peanut note that I think you were tasting before,
mm-hmm.
which I wonder if that might be the yeast, actually. Because yeast can sort of lend those foxy, weird, like, peanut notes to the background,
right.
which are totally appealing.
This is great.
Mm-hmm.
So in the U.S., well, and I guess the whole world market.
Sure.
When rye started to, I guess, well, going back a little bit before that, people's palates started changing. They were going for lighter spirits. Canadian Club and Crown Royal just like
Smirnoff,
started blowing
yeah,
up.
Totally.
You know? It took a while for the palate to change back to enjoying things like this and liking a little bit of grit and some balls behind your whiskey, you know?
Sure, sure.
It's really exciting to see all the new brands that are coming out as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely.
You know, there's so many craft distillers, and, like, I mean, even in New York alone, there are quite a few now.
Pile of them. And they are doing great things, and they've done a huge amount to sort of take whiskey and, you know, for lack of a better term, make it sexy again. Mm-hmm. Like, it's like this is a local product that's being made locally, ideally. It's being done sort of in the old style. It harkens back to, you know, an earlier era where, you know, coming out of World War II or, you know, the mythical Great Golden Past where this is homespun product and American whiskey. And it's really difficult to get much more American than American rye or American bourbon.
Right.
I mean, I've been reading a lot on it lately. Social History of Bourbon is a great book by Carson. But, you know, I mean, like, we had distillation in this country from the minute this country was founded, because in most cases, unless you were on the far eastern seaboard in a port city, it made much more sense to distill some of what you were producing.
Absolutely.
for ease of the market. In fact, the Whiskey Rebellion, which happened right after this country was brought together, at Pennsylvania, and there was a little bit in Kentucky and Maryland as well, was mostly a big issue because in order to pay the war debts that we accrued as a country, we started charging immediately excise taxes on stills. You could pay either a fixed amount per, the capacity of your still, or pay a number of cents on every gallon that your still produced. But the big thing was that this excise had to be paid in currency. And for those who aren't aware, like in western Pennsylvania, Kentucky, all of the sort of frontier regions of the country at that point, there was no U.S. currency.
Right.
Everything was done by barter, and whiskey was actually effectively like the medium of exchange. See, the double hit of the government that you had appointed to fight the British from taxing you began taxing something that was very near and dear. I mean, you would make your own whiskey back in the day, much like you would salt your own pork or chop a tree down or, till your own fields. It was just something that everyone did. And not only were you being taxed suddenly on something that was considered a very, personal thing, but you were being taxed on money that you didn't have.
Right.
Understandably, people were a little bit angry about this.
Yeah, they got a little pissed off about that.
And the Western rye world, sort of rye took its first big blow at that point, obviously, because Pennsylvania was pretty harshly shut down. I think George Washington marched 13,000 troops into eastern Pennsylvania, pretty much straight away. And while the old saw that bourbon started when everyone fled down to Kentucky isn't strictly the case, Kentucky was a little bit farther out and a little bit more on its own. So bourbon was able to develop a little bit more there. So we do have all these new local producers. But there are some things that only the older whiskey houses can do. Often, frequently, in modern whiskeys that are being produced, the distillers don't mash their own grain. They'll purchase mash from a brewer, and then they'll distill that mash after they've fermented it. In a number of cases, in very fine whiskeys, I might add, like these labels, they don't even have a distillery. They purchase whiskey from one of the major producers, which is a time-honored practice, and then bottle it under their own. And it's, you could say it's slightly misleading because they refer to their distilleries. But
that's common of other areas of the spirit world. For instance, like in cognac, not everyone has a still house. They buy.
Most everyone doesn't actually. Right. I mean, they produce so little of their own stuff, but.
And they buy from different places and they blend it. And
I mean, however,
Scotch, do a lot of that
absolutely.
Too.
But it's interesting to note that the Bottle and Bond Act, and a lot of people are confused when you talk about Bottle and Bond. Had a couple of discussions recently. It was actually a first attempt to establish purity, and a guarantee of quality on whiskey. Because what you had going on was people would purchase barrels of whiskey from a whiskey producer, and by the time it hit the consumer, it had been watered down to a fairly low proof and cut with a great deal of other things. All the early distillation handbooks and bartending handbooks talk about how to create bourbon whiskey, and you can look at Fleischmann's Guide actually from the 1890s, and he's one of the better of them. But blending was endemic. So the Bottled and Bond Act was dropped, I believe, in 1897, before the Pure Food and Drug Act, which we'll talk about in just 10 seconds. And it said, all right, this whiskey is going to be aged at a government-bonded warehouse under government lock and key for a minimum of 4 years. It's going to be bottled at exactly 100 proof. Mm-hmm. It's going to be the product of one distillery and one season. The market had just been flooded by a bunch of whiskeys, which were frankly crap because everyone was buying and there was no guarantee of quality whatsoever. Which, is interesting today because one product I looked at recently, which is by a fine company, I noticed on their label that it's referred to, it's got, a state, and then it says whiskey. But in very light gold coloring between the state and the whiskey, it says spirit. And this is, this is a small producer who we all love, and they want to make a whiskey of their own eventually someday, but it's a little disingenuous because spirit whiskey is actually a congressional category. It's one step slightly higher than a blended whiskey. It has to be 21% straight whiskeys and can be no more than 79% grain neutral spirit.
I did not know that.
I know. And
That's why you're back on the show.
What can I say? I was looking at the bottle the other day. I'm like, wait a minute, let's take a look at what this is. So it's not, strictly disingenuous, but it's not a poor quality product, but you're definitely peddling these things as whiskeys that are being produced as whiskeys and straight whiskeys, except the consumer doesn't really understand what a straight whiskey is anymore.
Right.
And this is very similar kind of to what we might have had going on like in the period before Bottle and Bond. And it's interesting that with the rise of these independent distillers who are trying to get off the ground, you know, we have more of these products being passed off as whiskey that are not really technically what you or I or a whiskey drinker would consider to be whiskey. And the old houses have the advantage. If you talk about Jim Beam, if you talk about Maker's Mark, if you talk about Wild Turkey or any of just the big boys in this business, yeah. Heaven Hill, like these guys have production facilities and aging capabilities that the smaller guys just don't have for the most part because they're big and they're established. Many of them still use wild yeast, propagated that was originally propagated wildly, wet yeast in what are called Donna jugs. I don't know of any micro distiller right now that's propagating their own yeast. And if anyone does, please hunt me down and contact me because I'd be fascinated.
Yeah.
So, you know, now the older houses, though, are still a little bit behind the times for the most part on catching up with the whiskey trend. I think one of the big exceptions would be Buffalo Trace, who've very shrewdly capitalized on the desire for new products. But in a lot of other cases, you still see these, what you sort of refer to in the trade as legacy labels, like Old Overholt. Old Overholt was retained as a brand because it had passionate drinkers who were very loyal to their brand. Mm-hmm. Most of those people are probably, you know, at least in a retirement home at this point, to be generous. And then there are a couple of us crazy, you know, younger types who've just reconnected with rye, which mostly started to happen in, I'd say, what, 2004, 2005?
Yeah, I mean, mid-2000. And, you know, I think a lot of us got into it, you know, for different reasons, but definitely the cocktail boom had a lot to do with that. And, you know, people just, you know, collecting like this and hunting down these products.
Oh, yeah.
Finding, absolutely. You know, driving down the road, you know, in the middle of nowhere and stopping into the liquor store just to see what they have, you know.
A bottle of Stitzel Weller, like bourbon, like old Fitzgerald made back in the day by Julian Van Winkle when he was, Pappy Van Winkle, when he was still distilling. You can still find these bottles on the internet. You can still find them in a couple of stores. They go for astoundingly high prices, but we're going to the break at this point, I believe. So yep. I'll pour out the next tasting, and we'll take a second here.
Cool.
And we'll be right back with you.
All right, cool. Back with Nick Jarrett in just a moment.
By Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
And we're back. You're listening to The Speakeasy. In the studio today, we have good friend of the show, Nick Jarrett. We've been talking about a lot of really interesting stuff pertaining to the laws, actually, and like the history of American whiskey and the differences between, you know, bottled and bond and spirit whiskey.
Straight whiskey. Straight whiskey, absolutely.
All this stuff. Really cool stuff. And really talking about the history of why these things have changed so much over the years. And, you know, we were talking about the Whiskey Rebellion before and
excise taxes,
and they just recently, I guess it was like maybe 4 or 5 years ago, changed the excise tax for a distillery in New York State. It was like $50,000 a year,
yeah,
and they dropped it down to $2,500 a year.
Sure, sure. So, for just general licensing and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe that they're working with the Senate right now. The American Distillers Institute is working with the Senate right now on lowering the excise tax for micro producers. Yeah. They might have even already succeeded in that, which, you know, are producers who generate less than, say, you know, again, your big boys like Heaven Hill, Wild Turkey, and so forth, to allow a little bit more room for innovation and so on.
Yeah. And, you know, there was a time when, like we were talking about, when the when the Whiskey Rebellion popped up, and all these people were like, what the hell? You're trying to charge me for what I've been doing this whole
forever.
Time?
Like, even the British didn't charge for me to distill whiskey.
Yeah, dude, come on.
Yeah.
And it was the first tax in the United States.
Absolutely.
In the history of the United States. And it got a whole bunch of other taxes started.
It was wildly unpopular. I mean, it lasted from, I think, 1792 and change, or maybe even the 1780s to 1806 or 1802. Mm-hmm. Jefferson wasn't having any of it.
Yeah.
It was then repealed. Of course, it was quickly instituted again the minute we got into the War of 1812, because once you've realized that you can pay taxes pretty quickly by raising revenue,
yeah,
on something like whiskey or, you know, cigarettes or whatever else you charge people for, you didn't figure out income until later on. But yeah.
And now, you know, that's really one of the things that started, it's one of the main reasons why there are moonshiners, you know?
Exactly. And, yeah, just a modern conception of moonshine. I wanted to touch on a really interesting product that came out recently, which is Jonathan Forrester's Dutch's Moonshine, which is a sugar wash moonshine, which if you want to taste what moonshine really tastes like these days, by all means go out and buy yourself a jug of Jonathan Forrester's Moonshine. Because the days of moonshiners producing, you know, idyllic corn whiskeys and unaging them out in the hills somewhere, like, that hasn't been the reality since probably the Whiskey Rebellion, or yeah, at least the 1870s, 1880s. It's certainly in Prohibition, like, all the moonshine was made from sugar. Mm-hmm. So, if you taste that, it's a very accurate moonshine in comparison to some of the real moonshines I've had out of milk jugs in the past. Which, you know, I mean, it's rum. It's rum.
Yeah.
So, to my knowledge, like, with the exception of perhaps a couple tiny, tiny holdouts and perhaps old guys out in the hills and families that do it, there aren't really that many people producing moonshine that's whiskey.
I wish I would have known that we were going to talk about this today, because I actually have some Western Pennsylvania moonshine from up in the hills.
Oh, good Lord.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably up around 140 proof or so.
Sure, Popskull. I mean,
yeah,
you know, it's white lightning, all right. You will see lightning by the time you're done with it.
Absolutely.
It'll get you where you're going. But, yeah, back to whiskey, I guess. Well, we were going to talk a little bit about the Pure Food and Drug Act, which was just sort of the final like thing that legislated, that almost superseded the Bottled and Bond Act, which said, okay, whiskey has to be this. Has right. to be at least 50% corn. It has to be just whiskey. But Bottled and Bond, which, you know, we touch on because the old overhaul we have in front of us today is Bottled and Bond, sort of hung on because even in those couple of years, which it had only been around for 9 years before the Pure Food and Drug Act came out, people began to look at sort of Bottled and Bond as being a mark, a guarantee of quality.
Right.
You knew that if your whiskey was bonded, it was good whiskey, and even after the Pure Food and Drug Act, people were still going for the bonded, which commanded a premium over other whiskeys. Which today, actually, ironically, Bottled and Bond does not command the premium over other whiskeys.
Right.
By any means. I mean, you can go out and buy a bottle of Rittenhouse, and the price has gone up on that for still under around $20 a bottle.
Yeah,
you can buy a bottle of Old Granddad Bottled and Bond for under $20 a bottle. You can buy a bottle of Laird's for like 17 or 18. But, you know, Prohibition hit and everyone's tastes changed. And then the 60s rolled up in the 50s and people started moving towards lighter spirits. And whiskey, at least the major houses, has been on a little bit of a downhill slant ever since then. You have great products like Old Overholt, which was a rye, which Jim Beam pretty much just held on to because it was a legacy label.
Right.
I mean, they have their own Jim Beam straight rye. It's a yellow label. It's hypothetically the same juice as the Old Overhaul, but in a tasting that we did a couple weeks back, we found them pretty markedly different.
Absolutely.
But, you know, sort of a race to the bottom on stuff like this. Like, it dropped from 100 proof at some point, maybe in the 70s, 60s, 70s, to 86 proof. Definitely, it's not 8 years old anymore. The age probably dropped down to 6 years. Ironically, everyone used to declare age. For bottle and bond, you used to have to declare age.
Right.
Which we've sort of let slip by the wayside. We don't declare the season it's made in anymore. pardon me.
Yeah.
We're drinking a little bit of Old Fitzgerald bottle and bond right now, actually, which is another product that's not yet available in New York, but if we have our way, it will be very soon, because it's a rock star bourbon at 100 proof, bottled it in bond style. And one of the things I love personally about bottled and bond is, in addition to it being at 100 proof, which is just a little bit of extra bang for your buck, it has to be made by one distillery, but most importantly, in one season. Now, pretty much none of the other whiskeys that are bottled and bond, except for Evan Williams Single Barrel, which we're going to come to in a minute, and then Old Forester has their birthday bourbon, have a specific season or vintage dated. Most whiskey houses now blend across seasons, and any age declaration there is a minimum age of the blend. When you have a whiskey that's distilled in one season, it's really more of a showpiece for the skill of the distiller and of the house, because you can't cover up defects and imperfections in the whiskey by blending it with whiskeys from another season. Sort of a truer expression of whiskey, if you will, which is fantastic. I mean, I love my whiskey. Yeah. And
I mean, does most of the Buffalo Trace antique collection, don't they put the season in the year?
Good one. Good one. But those are specifically collector whiskeys.
Right.
And you have your choice.
We're talking about something we can get off the shelf for, you know, $30 or so.
Oh, sure. And I mean, like, they are incredibly underpriced. Mad allocated. I mean, it can be tough to track down. But there you've got your choice of one 17-year-old bourbon, one 18-year-old rye, a really, really in-your-face cask-strength bourbon at 15 years, I believe the stag is, right? Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not sure about the age on the hand or the Weller, but two more really overproof rye and wheat whiskeys specifically. So not your everyday sipping whiskeys. Some would even say that the 17 and the 18 years on a whiskey, or even the 15 years on a bourbon, is a little overaged. I mean, I tend to like my whiskeys a little bit younger, with a couple of exceptions.
Anywhere from like 12 to 15 is a good, you've got a good window there. But for ryes, I don't know, man.
You sure.
21 to 24, 25-year-old rye.
Well, they've got longevity. Like, I mean, this happened during Prohibition again, where you weren't distilling new stock, but you were having old bottles come off that had been held throughout the entirety of Prohibition, distilled 1917 and bottled in like 1933. Mm-hmm. So a little bit older, and to a degree perhaps the taste for older whiskeys really came about a little bit more after that for the remaining whiskey drinkers. But one of my favorite whiskeys that's not bond, that is Jim Beam White Label.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 4 years old, maybe four to six, but we'll call it 4 years old comfortably, and it's a straight bourbon, and you can taste the yeast, you can taste the wood, you can taste the mash. So, you know, if you want all of that, like, after 12 to 15 years, you're beginning to taste mostly the wood. And in the case of rye, in some cases, the mash, like Elijah Craig 18-year, like, it's a fantastic whiskey, but, like, it's all smoke and leather, which is, you know, all the barrel right there.
Which I actually like, but I don't want to get too far away from the original product either.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with it. Like, every now and then for a special occasion, it's nice to sip on a really old whiskey, but by that token, like, 8 years. And that's another one of the things, too. Like, the declaration, Wild Turkey used to declare as being 8 years old.
Right.
More and more, most American whiskeys are losing their age declarations on the label, especially the main brands.
More and more, we're starting to lose some of these brands, too. I mean, we talk about all these new craft distilleries popping up, but now there are rumors of Wild Turkey pulling their 101 rye.
Yeah, which, I mean, I haven't personally confirmed, but I've been hearing a lot of buzz over it, which would really be a tragedy, because that's a, you know, Wild Turkey is one of those sort of, I mean, they're not technically a high rye bourbon, but they come off that way, and they are a very, very old school producer. They do a lot of things that other distilleries don't do anymore, just in terms of barrel management, aging, mash bill, yeast propagation. Wild Turkey 101, which again used to be declared as 8 years and is now probably substantially younger. I mean, again, we're talking probably six years.
4 to 6, I mean.
Because the money in whiskey is all on the old whiskeys, ironically.
Yeah.
Because you're charged on, your taxes are not on the years, your taxes are on the alcohol.
Right.
So the older your whiskey is and the more you can charge for it, the more profit you make off of it. Whereas in other businesses, you look at something that's cheaper and you're being taxed on the percentage of the cost.
Right.
So that's another reason why we have sort of products like Old Overholt and so forth that are a little bit endangered, because they aren't the big money makers.
Right. And there's only really a small circle of us who care about it.
Well, I mean, frankly, again, with the exception of a couple of cities like New Orleans and so forth, if it weren't for the cocktail boom, some of these brands like 10, 11, 12 years in might not be here for much longer.
Right.
The cocktail resurgence has sort of kept a lot of these old horses going, which is a fantastic side effect.
Yeah. we wouldn't be drinking Rittenhouse, that's for sure, if
God no, I mean,
hadn't come back.
Yeah. I mean, I enjoy it. It's not what most people would look at as being sipping whiskey. And that sort of brings me to the whole point of the whole Occupy whiskey thing that we sort of kicked around a little bit drunkenly the other day at lunch. Some of these older companies are still trying to get with the program, if you will, have been releasing new products. Like Jim Beam dropped a new rye a couple of years back, which was sort of met with mixed reception, which was their rye wine product. And I'd just like to throw it out there as sort of a challenge. It's like, well, why don't you keep the old overhaul regular and then throw some of it into a bonded warehouse, age it for 8 years.
Absolutely.
Bring it back to its sort of heritage as a bourbon. You know, it's a shame that we're losing this heritage of these older bourbons. Like, these bottled and bond whiskeys are such throwbacks. What we're going to sip on now is a little bit of Evan Williams Single Barrel, which is vintage dated. It's meeting a lot of the requirements for bonding. It's just a little underproof. It's 10 years old, but it would have been comparable, if a little bit lighter in alcohol, to some of these products in their heyday.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about, I mean, in your honest opinion, what do you think is going to happen with the future of these whiskeys? I mean, do you think that the companies will come back around and decide that it's something that's worth their time and effort to kind of preserve? I mean, as far as like the historical side and, you know, matched up with the sales and everything.
I think that's a really interesting point. And that sort of touches on where cocktails are going as well as everything else. Liquor companies sort of tend to look at two demographics of customers. They look at their sort of low-end, like younger kids drinking quantity for cheap. Then they look at their sort of, connoisseur customers. They don't really necessarily look for an overlap between the two, nor do they put the emphasis on, it makes a little. I'd say that blended whiskey consumption, American blended whiskey consumption in this country right now, without looking at the numbers, has to be down to pretty much a record low.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that anyone's buying Philadelphia or Hollers, whatever, or Fleischmann's or Imperial or any of these sort of Americans. Oh, God. I mean, all right, they're moving in the wells of dive bars, like one of the ones I work at. I'll take that back. But I always try to tell the people who are ordering, I'm like, just pay the extra dollar.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, what you were saying about the actual high-end versus low-end consumer, I mean, I have to slightly disagree with you there, because I think, like companies like Buffalo Trace, which is probably my favorite distillery.
Absolutely.
They're all right there, like, in the pocket,
Like, oh, yeah.
Like anywhere from their Buffalo Trace to even the 12-year Pappy Van Winkle.
I mean, even if you dig up some of their like budget products, like they're producing Tom Moore now still, I think.
Yeah.
Which is one of the bottled and bonds. Mm-hmm. I know they bought up Barton a couple years back, which had a lot of that portfolio.
Yeah, they have a bottled and bond Barton.
And
which is an 8-year bottled and bond.
Exactly. Barton has a couple.
Perfect example.
And whenever we talk about Buffalo Trace, I mean, we do a lot of these whiskeys, the slightly younger and older labels. A bit of a disservice when we talk about the newer whiskeys that come out instead, because they're sexy.
Yeah.
When there's a huge product portfolio that they're capitalizing on the recipes and the methodologies from, which, and Buffalo Trace is actually great for respect to their heritage. I mean, they just dropped the Colonel Taylor bourbon, which is a lovely product. Obviously, they have George T. Stagg, Thomas Handy, which are all named after senior sort of figures in the whiskey world. But that mid-range, once again, like, I'd love to see a little bit more capitalization from the other distilleries on, all right, old overhaul, here's a rye. Rye is popular. Don't try to release some new rye and new packaging. Take the rye that moves for you.
Yep.
Go back, again, sort of touching on its heritage, which is appropriate because this is the Heritage Radio Network. Let's go back and drink old style, whiskey the way that it was consumed. If not necessarily pre-prohibition, because it's really tough to tell what pre-prohibition whiskey tasted like. After, 100 years in the bottle, it picks up a lot of flavors that weren't necessarily there to begin with.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's great having guys like you around who bring in these old bottles so we can actually get a taste of the past.
Oh, absolutely. I'm bummed that I couldn't bring in that bottle of Monticello, which is one of the premier Maryland ryes. And they were famous for being a blending house, but it's a straight rye blend.
Well, when you come on next time,
yeah, exactly.
I'll bring my vintage bottle of Applejack.
Oh, we'll
taste them side by side. Well, you know what? Let's bring some other stuff. I have an old bottle of Campari that Tiki Adam gave me. We'll taste them side by side. We'll have a really fun.
A little bit of the side by sides is interesting. I mean, like, this is it's again, like, whiskey is such a fundamentally American product. Laird's, you know, I was tickled pink to be working in North Carolina maybe last year and seeing bottles of Captain Applejack down there.
Nice.
Which, when they moved from New Jersey, because you couldn't afford to buy apples in New Jersey anymore, because where are the apple orchards? Down to West Virginia. Like, you know, that was the last remaining other Applejack, and they still package it with the label that it had at the time. You know, these are the things that are great about being a spirits lover, you know, an aficionado of whiskeys. Like, it doesn't always have to be the high end. And, you know, we just hope not to lose a lot of the heritage and see a lot of these great old brands. We were talking about J.W. Dom. Mm-hmm. I mean, Mellow Corn is one that, like, has seen a little bit more distribution, really, which is bonded straight corn whiskey. Is it a year?
It's only, like, a year or two.
Well, corn whiskey got that special exemption when everyone defined it. Like, it's the only whiskey that's allowed to be aged for, like, up to a year without having to declare it. But, yeah, I mean, this is what people's grandparents were drinking. This is what people were drinking during Prohibition. This is what people were drinking, like, throughout the heartland of the country. And this is what cocktails were based on.
Absolutely.
Like, I mean, if you want to make a truly authentic pre-Prohibition whiskey, you know, go ahead and add some Everclear to it, and maybe some caramel food coloring and a couple other things. That's your Old West cocktail for you. But in the toitier bars that Jerry Thomas and Harry Johnson, like the Knickerbocker and so forth, these were using, you know, these products.
Absolutely.
And, like, going back in search of that heritage and sort of, you know, showing a little bit of love to what came before is what we're all about.
Absolutely. Nick, it's been great having you on the show.
Damon, it's always a pleasure.
The website is going to be coming out soon. It's OccupyWhiskey.com.
Yeah, we do own the domain name.
We own the domain. So it'll be chock full of all this kind of great information, reposts of old articles, and just whole lot of history about whiskey.
Ridiculous demands on big corporations about releasing whiskeys that we want to drink.
Exactly.
Hell yeah.
Thanks again for coming on the show. I'm Damon Bolte, Nick Jarrett. We'll see you next time. Cheers.
Man, I wouldn't lie to get higher than a kite. Now when you
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Man, I wouldn't lie, the jet's higher than a kite. Boys, he's high, just look at them two black eyes. You know I wouldn't lie, he's higher than the sky. When you see him tipping round and round the block,
dog it, Mom.
Know that cat is very beat, beat clean down to his socks. That cat is high, boys, I wouldn't lie. Oh my, he's higher than a kite.
Take yeah. it, Charlie. Jumping.